I'm excited to bring up Stephen Andrasco. Mr. Andrasco is a librarian and UFO enthusiast based in McAllen, Texas. He has assisted with a number of major UFO conferences, including the Roswell UFO Festival and the Laredo UFO Conference. He is an avid reader of science fiction and has a deep interest in the subject of extraterrestrial life. He is also a well-known public speaker and storyteller in South Texas, appearing frequently throughout the valley. He holds a master's degree in library science from the University of North Texas. Please welcome Mr. Stephen Andrasco.
Thank you. Well, good morning. I noticed I had a few of my ex-elementary students here today. They're a little bit older now, but it was fun to see them. And most of you here today are familiar with some of the more famous UFO cases, like the 1947 crash near Roswell, New Mexico, or the 1961 Betty and Barney Hill case that happened in New Hampshire, or the case in 1973 of an abduction near Pascagoula, Mississippi. And later today, you're going to hear Travis Walton's story that happened in 1975 in the Arizona mountains. So I'm looking forward to that. But what about right here in our own backyard? Well, today I'm going to be talking about some of the better documented cases here in the border area of Texas and Mexico. Some of these are written about in some of Noe's books, like the 1948 incident that happened near Laredo, Texas, only about a year after the Roswell incident. And in 1955, there was another case near Del Rio, Texas. And in 1974, there was a famous case Noe wrote about in his book, Mexico's Roswell. It happened across the river Presidio, Texas, near Coyame, Mexico. But last year, in 2012, there were over 7,000 UFO sightings reported here in the United States. And in the last 10 years, there have been over 60 reported cases to MUFON from Starr County, Hidalgo County, and Cameron County alone. And those you can, if you go to the MUFON website, you can read about there. And those are just the cases that are were reported. Now, I've known Noe for over 20 years and have kind of tagged along with him to various events like this. And as I have gone with him, I've had many people come and tell me their personal accounts of UFO experiences that they've had. And so that's how it began. It kind of sparked my interest, and I began doing my own research and reading about a lot of these cases. So today we're going to talk about some of the things that have happened here, and Noe and I like to call those the South Texas X-Files. Now, this first one that we'll talk about today happened in 1966, just north of Edinburgh. And this incident is reported by Milo Ponce's son, Joe. Now, Milo was a deputy sheriff in 1966 and later became the county commissioner here in the... And this is an aerial view of where it happened along FM Road 490, just north of Edinburgh. And in October or November of that year, Milo Ponce was a deputy sheriff in Hidalgo County, and he received a phone call about midnight, according to his son, from the dispatcher. And he stated that someone had called to report a group of men that were very disturbed standing along the side of the road. And so these eight men who were digging a caliche pit in the area were reported to be very greatly agitated. They were yelling and screaming for help, and so a motorist stopped and took them to a nearby truck stop where they called the sheriff's department. Now, according to Joe, when his father received the phone call, he asked the dispatcher if it was serious or if it was a prank call. And Mr. Rapp told him that the men seen along the highway appeared to be very frightened, and they also said they needed help putting out a fire that had been started there. So he got dressed, got in his vehicle, and headed out to the area. Now, these pits were being dug by a crew of 8 men from North Texas, kind of roughneck types, and they all told the same story. In fact, one of the men had been so frightened that he had wet himself. And the men were later taken to the sheriff's office where they were all interviewed and allowed to spend the night. And none of them wanted to go back to the area where they had been working and staying. And reportedly, they left town the next day very happy that they were still alive. Now, the workers told the deputies that they had seen bright lights and they heard a loud sound, and that wind began to blow on a calm night. And that flame shot down out of the sky, and they set the surrounding area on fire, including some of their vehicles and the motorhome that they were staying in. Now, this is an aerial photo of what the area looks like. You can see the caliche pit and the road there. This is a close-up of what the caliche pit looks like today. And this is what it looks like out in that area. And Mr. Ponce is showing, you know, if you don't know what caliche is, if you're not from South Texas, you kind of know. He shows a little picture here of what they were digging up. And looks like maybe a piece of their, what was left over of their mobile home that they were living in. Now, Mr. Ponce tells, I guess I don't, the audio part didn't come on. Well, anyway, that's a picture of Mr. Ponce, and he talks about what happened when we interviewed him and what he remembers about that night. And also, there was another resident in the area named Manito, or his nickname Manito, and he also reported seeing a cigar-shaped object that was hovering over the area, and he had seen it not just on the night of this occurrence, but on many other occasions. And the workers also had stated they'd seen these strange lights hovering prior to the night of the fire. Now, people that lived in that area called these lights La Luz del Llano, the lights of the fields. And they also said that this area seemed to be an area where a strange phenomenon had happened for years. Now, Joe said that the sheriff at that time told his dad that he had been approached afterwards by 2 men in military uniforms asking to see a report about the incident. Now, Mr. Vickers was a resident of Donna, and he was the sheriff from 55 until 69. And he thought that the men might have come from Moore Air Base, which is located near the area. But that air base actually had been closed 3 years prior to that. So we're not sure where these military men came from that came to the sheriff's office. Said no more was ever said about the incident, and Joe said his father never spoke about it anymore. And then later, we found another witness named David Newton that talked about things that went on in that area. He said it had been noted for strange lights, possibly gases associated with caliche pit pools, but frequently mentioned that trainers and trainees that flew at the Air Force base would see unusual things as they were taking their training flights, especially at night. Most of these were combat veterans from the Korea and World War II, and they would suggest that sometimes they felt that they were being monitored by intelligently operated craft of an unknown origin. Sometimes this would happen to them during the day, but mostly these things occurred at night. And also, the same man reported was a witness to the summer 1953 mass sighting of UFOs that happened here in McAllen. That was a good time because that's when I was born, the summer of 53. So. And on this particular occasion, it was early in the morning that David Newton recalls as a child that he and his brother and his brother's girlfriend and others were sitting outside when they saw six or seven flying discs moving back and forth very quickly across the skies over McAllen. And it was very well known. It was reported on the news there. I talked with a friend of mine whose father was a newscaster at that time, but he's the same age as I am and was therefore very little when it happened. And he doesn't remember much about his father talking about it. But many people saw these discs. They were glowing in color, and they were flying at an altitude of probably about 40,000 feet. And sometimes they flew in diagonal formation, but other times they moved around independently. And they saw this from downtown McAllen on 12th Street between Cedar and Date Palm. And they were visible, you know, to the naked eye. You could see them. And they seemed to be traveling very fast, much faster than an aircraft. And they traveled for about 2 hours in a kind of a circular pattern where they flew south, southeast into Mexico and then back towards Padre Island and returned back to the Edinburgh area, and they seemed to circle back and forth for about 2 hours. So people were able to observe these events for quite a long time. Another witness emailed us and said she did remember the UFO incident one morning in 1953. Her name was Mary Lou Fouts. And so we had at least one other witness confirm that remembers that when she was a young girl here in McAllen area. Another incident that happened just about a year ago was reported to me by a friend of mine. She had recently lost her husband, and I was over at her house visiting. And another one of her friends named Natalie, who lived not far from here in Edinburgh, well, while I was there, Nadine said, "Natalie, why don't you tell Steve your story?" And so I asked her about it, and she told me one night she got up, she couldn't sleep, and she went to the kitchen to get a drink of water. And while she was getting a drink, she looked out the kitchen window and saw this light that she'd never seen before. So she thought it was an airplane coming in to land, but it didn't seem to move. And she began to wash some of the dishes in the sink, and it still remained in the same spot. So she decided to go outside and take a closer look. But from the front of her house, she couldn't really see it. So she got in her car, drove up Jackson Avenue towards University. And she could see the object bright in the sky. And she headed west on University Avenue over to Conroy, where she then headed north towards kind of like Moore Air Base. Well, she drove not too far when there was two highway patrolmen blocking the road. There was a roadblock there. And so she stopped her car, got out, and while looking at this large craft that was hovering not too far away, she went up to one of the officers and asked, "Do you see what I see?" And he stated, "Yes, ma'am." And she couldn't, they didn't talk about it or anything, so she got back in her car and wanted to wake up her husband and tell him about it. But she said by the time she returned back to her home in Edinburgh that the light had disappeared. Since that time, she's moved to the Houston area. Her husband worked for Halliburton, and they were transferred back to Houston. Another interesting case happened near Zapata, and if you've been out to Zapata, and when I first moved to the Valley, I lived in Rio Grande City. My wife taught in Roma, and I used to take the Boy Scouts camping out near the lake. And this happened to a Spanish teacher who happened to be the senior class sponsor at the high school, and he worked the concession stands at the football games. And after one football game, he was working late, counting the money, getting ready for deposit, when he began to head home. He was driving in his Ram Charger truck, and headed east on Highway 83 towards his home, which is about 17 miles from the school. He'd gone about 12 miles when he saw some bright lights in the mirror of his truck. This is kind of the direction that he was driving, an approximate area where this occurred along Lake Falcone. If any of you have ever driven out there, there's not too much between Roma and Zapata out in that area. So late at night, it's pretty dark out there. And he was looking in his mirror, and he saw these colored lights inside a larger object. And on the underside, there was fire, a spark shooting out. He drew this sketch of what looked like it seems like it's always described as a cigar-looking shape with orange, blue, and white lights blinking off and on, and it appeared to be about 18 feet in diameter. The object came right over his truck, so he pulled over to the side of the road and turned off his lights, and he noticed other vehicles that were speeding past him. They weren't stopping. He said this UFO hovered right over the hood of his truck for approximately 30 seconds and then zoomed off into the air. Okay. Another case happened in Harlingen. This is right out of Project Blue Book in 1966, and it was recorded by a family and their children. And in this case, this family was at a park, and they saw a dark object hovering that looked kind of like an upside-down cup. And three of his children said they saw the square yellow light open like a doorway. And inside, they saw what appeared to be a very small dwarf wearing black coveralls that, when he moved, would shimmer a golden shimmer. So moments later, the door closed and the object moved away from the house, emitting a soft humming sound as it vanished. Well, interestingly enough, the same family, about a month later, had another sighting near Sam Houston Park. And this one, the children were watching TV at their house. Back in the old days, they didn't have cable and satellite. That you had the old rabbit ears or antenna on the roof, and their picture became very blurry. And they looked outside, and they saw this fantastic spinning light hovering in the sky and illuminating their house with a beam of light. So the same families had two experiences within a month of each other there. In 1966 in Harlingen, it was recorded in the Project Blue Book. Another encounter happened near Brownsville in 1986, about 20 years later. Two witnesses driving back to home saw what they thought was a bright star approaching their vehicle. They stopped and watched and noticed another man doing the same thing. As the object came closer, they could make out a saucer-shaped craft, and the object hovered over their vehicle at about the height of a two-story building. This area is close to Hanna High School, where they saw this object. The lower the part was very bright and surrounded by what seemed to be a 10-foot section area, which all of a sudden started emitting lights. Sometimes they were in a pattern, and sometimes they went in different directions. And above the area of the lights, there were some windows. And the witnesses said they saw figures moving around inside the craft. They described them as human-shaped, except that they had very long and thin arms. They were very frightened, and they drove away. And as they did, they noticed helicopters that were flying in the direction of where the UFO had headed. I believe they said that they had seen three military helicopters. I'm not sure where in 1986 those helicopters, what base they would have come from, but I'm guessing maybe Corpus Christi area. Another sighting happened to one of our students from Mac High, who lives in McAllen, and he spotted outside their home in the middle of the day, a bright object that he filmed. And you could kind of see it moving across the sky there. And on several occasions, the Thrashers, Israel, and his mother, who works as a special ed teacher at our school, have come in and told Noe and I about the things that they've seen right out in front of their house, and a lot of times during the daytime hours. Now, in one of Noe's books, Fallen Angel, describes a case that happened about a year after the Roswell crash. And this is a very well-documented case that happened in Laredo. And we've been to several conferences in Laredo where people have actually come and told us that they remember this happening. It was first spotted in the afternoon, traveling at a high rate of speed over the state of Washington, and was moving south. It flew down towards Arizona, where it turned, and it was reportedly being chased by two military jets. Along the route, it took a turn into New Mexico. Some accounts claim that the jets fired on this object and may have been responsible for downing it, the jet. There are many newspaper articles and magazine articles that we've read about that. And as it dropped in altitude, it began to be very wobbly, and it finally went out of radar range around Laredo. Triangulation located it about 30 or 40 miles south of Laredo, where it crashed on the Mexican side of the border. This crash occurred at a point where near the Sabinas and Rio Salado rivers join before they empty into the Rio Grande River. And this is approximate area where the crash took place. Sources said that a photographer in 1948 was sent to take pictures of the flying saucer and reportedly dead pilot that was inside the helicopter. He was also a photographer there that took a lot of pictures of atomic bomb testing and things that happened in New Mexico. As they flew down, they saw where the site had been, and it was still lit up at night. They had bright spotlights, and they could see that it was still smoking 12 hours after the crash had taken place. As they circled, they could see that the area was bathed in scattered debris, which looked kind of like foil all over the hillside there. The skin was apparently blown away in the explosion, and they described the foil as similar to what was in their cigarette packages, only much harder. They said they could not bend the material, and before anyone left the site, the military police searched them and confiscated any of the material that they had collected. Inside, they found one body, which was badly burned, and this is supposedly a copy of what might have been the photographs that were taken. He took a series of photographs, but the body was removed where he took pictures, and he described it as being about 4'6" with an extremely large head compared to the rest of the torso. He said the eyes were gone and there were no visible ears, nose, or lips, just a slit where teeth and a tongue would be. And the arms appeared to be much larger than human, and the hands appeared to have four claw-like appendages. And this was a case that happened near Laredo, and you can read more about it in Noe's book, Fallen Angel. Now, another sighting written about in Noe's book, Mexico's Roswell, happened in 1974. And this is a very interesting case. It was featured on the History Channel when Noe and Ruben Uriate went down and did some research, and the History Channel took them back down to film in the area. And this took place in 1974 when the radar screens picked up a very fast-moving object that was heading across the Gulf of Mexico towards Texas, headed towards Corpus Christi. They watched as it dropped from about 75,000 feet down as it headed towards the coast. As it got towards the coast, it slowed down, dropped in altitude, and then turned and zoomed down towards Brownsville, where then it headed northwest along the Rio Grande River. The object began streaking across northern Mexico while it was still descending in height. Meanwhile, at the same time, there was a small plane headed out of El Paso towards Mexico City. Unknowingly to the pilot, they were moving right into the path of this oncoming UFO. And around 10:30 p.m., the two radar blips came together over the skies of Coyame out in the Chihuahua Desert. Here they collided, and there was a huge explosion as the UFO slammed into the desert in an area called El Llano. It's really kind of out in a desolate area there, south of Presidio, Texas. This is a kind of an aerial view of what the area looks like south of the Rio Grande there. Soldiers arrived to the scene and found a disc-shaped object on the ground, and it was nearly intact. It only had two holes in it, and it was described as being about 16 feet in diameter with no windows and doors, about 5 feet tall, and had damaged on both ends of the craft. Meanwhile, a U.S. team was headed out of Fort Bliss in El Paso, and they were readied for action. They took off in four Vietnam-era helicopters, some of them Huey and some of them Sea Stallions, and headed towards the area to enter into Candelaria, and from there went into Mexico. Arriving at the scene, they were in their biohazard suits. They found all the Mexican soldiers that had arrived there first, all dead. So the Americans took over the operation, attached the UFO to a giant helicopter, and flew it out of the area. After it was removed, they put the what was left of the Mexican vehicles and the soldiers, and the area was exploded to incinerate the evidence. Apparently, the men don't know what caused them to all be killed, but they don't know if it was, you know, biological or radiation or what happened. They moved this spacecraft to an area in the Davis Mountains, and then it was put on a truck and sent to Atlanta.
August 25th, 1974. Coyame, Mexico is home to its own mysterious, and some say lethal, UFO incident. It is a place not found on many maps, and is home to more agave plants than people. But several of those who do live here claim the following event is real.
This is taken from the History Channel program between Noe and Ruben Yura.
The town's inhabitants are beginning to turn in for the night. 500 miles away, United States Air Defense Systems suddenly register an unknown object flying over the Gulf of Mexico, streaking across the sky at over 2,500 miles per hour at an altitude of 75,000 feet. Only one thing is for certain. This is not something man-made. Initial indications are that it's probably nothing more than a meteor. But 60 seconds later, it becomes clear that's impossible.
This object was traveling and descending through steps, unlike that of a meteor, again, with more of an arc.
The object appears headed on a course towards Corpus Christi, Texas. American air defense systems are alerted. Suddenly, the unidentified flying object veers left and enters Mexican airspace, just 40 miles south of Brownsville, Texas. The U.S. continues tracking the puzzling spacecraft as it now races over Mexico. Yet what isn't seen on radar is a small craft headed on a trajectory towards the UFO.
What's also interesting about this case is About the same time as this UFO was zigging and zagging, there was a plane that was leaving El Paso headed towards Mexico City.
The small civilian plane from El Paso heads towards Mexico's capital city, but never reaches its destination. At the same time, the American military watches as their unidentified flying object disappears from radar. It appears that the unthinkable has happened.
There's an assumption that there was a collision of some type where both the craft and the plane had collided.
The following morning, 9 hours after the civilian plane disappeared over the desert, a Mexican recovery team hunts for the downed craft. Across the border, American intelligence listens in. The Americans intercept a Mexican military radio report. The wreckage of the missing plane has been spotted just outside Coyame. Moments later, another report shockingly announces the sighting of a second wreck. But this is no plane.
The Mexican recovery team finds a sort of a silver-shaped classic disc, some 16 feet 5 inches, about 5 feet thick, convex on both sides, sort of like a saucer.
The saucer's surface has the appearance of polished steel. It has no markings, no lights, and there are no bodies inside. However, it does appear to be damaged in two spots, possibly caused by a collision with a civilian plane and then falling to the ground. Immediately, Mexican officials declare radio silence on all search activities. Meanwhile, U.S. officials reach out to the Mexican government, offering assistance in the recovery. Their offer is met with a denial.
The Mexican government denied it. They said, no, all we have is just a plane wreckage.
While the Mexican team collects the crash debris, the United States is busy assembling their own elite recovery force at Fort Bliss, Texas. Their team includes 4 helicopters, 3 small UEs, and a large Sea Stallion. A team is placed on standby while U.S. surveillance scopes out the situation.
The U.S. was keeping tabs again through its spy surveillance network, through their satellite surveillance as well as airplanes that were flying over at low altitude.
American surveillance reveals that the Mexicans have placed the UFO on a flatbed truck and moved from the crash site. Then some say satellite photos were taken that reveal a startling discovery. The Mexican convoy has stopped and something has gone wrong.
They were able to see there were a number of dead bodies, so which led them to believe that something extraordinary had happened.
If you want to read more about this very interesting incident, you can read about it in Noe's book, Mexico's Roswell. Now, I know my presentation was fast and didn't cover some of the questions you might ask, like, who are they, or where do they come from, or why are they here, or how come they never seem to want to talk to us? But maybe when we come to answer those questions about ourselves, maybe we could come to a better understanding of who they might be. And in the words of my now retired principal, I leave you with something to think about, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Dr. Friedman will be speaking next, and I'm sure you're looking forward to hearing from him. And I like to thank Noe for inviting me to come and speak to you today, and thank you all for being here.